Welcome to the never-ending quest for clarity. This is Loving Liberty with Brian Hyde.
Well, hello there and welcome to Loving Liberty. I'm Brian Hyde. I am so glad you could join me today. So much to talk about. And I have to start out with a special invitation to join us in our second hour when I have a very special guest joining me by phone. We're going to be talking with Chandra Meek Udi, who survived the killing fields of the Khmer Rouge in Cambodia. The reason I'm having Chandra on this program is because of all the people in the world that I know, she is one person who firsthand experienced what a communist revolution is like. And it's a very tragic experience, but there are some incredible lessons to be learned. She has shared this far and wide since she and the surviving members of her family made it to the United States. And she has a terrific message of hope, but she also has a very powerful message of warning. And I'm hoping that we can take something away from her message. Again, that's about an hour from now. We'll be sharing it here in the second hour of the program. Please, please join us. And if you have the opportunity or if you're so inclined, I would ask you, please share the podcast. Let people know. It's rare to have the voice of firsthand experience to be able to go to the source. I love to do this wherever possible because that is where you're going to get the most spin-free take on what's what. So we have that opportunity. In the meantime, we're going to be talking about this hour, how historic symbols, boy, they are on the chopping block. I mean, it's not just statues being pulled down. I don't know if you saw this. Aunt Jemima is now changing its name, removing its iconic image to appease the woke enforcers of society. And you just have to ask, where does this stop? Does it stop? Is it something that that will ever, you know, will it ever appease those people who really feel like we have got to reshape society in a way that we feel is best? You'll see there's a bit of a theme here, isn't there, right? Isn't that what the Khmer Rouge were doing to the tune of, what, 2.1 million people murdered in order to reshape that perfect society? Well, let's start with the symbol of Aunt Jemima. This is from NBC News. Aunt Jemima brand to change name, remove image that Quaker, that's the parent company, says is based on a racial stereotype. We recognize Aunt Jemima's origins are based on a racial stereotype, Quaker Oats said, adding that the move is an effort towards progress on racial equality. Whew, virtue signal received. Thank you, Quaker Oats. The story says Aunt Jemima brand of syrup and pancake mix will get a new name and image. I know this is rife with speculation. Okay, so what's the most woke name and image that they can come up with? I'm not going to go there for now. But the fact that they're saying, well, Aunt Jemima's origins are based on a racial stereotype. How far back does that brand go anyway? About 130 years. And it features a black woman named Aunt Jemima, who apparently was originally dressed as a minstrel character. Now, the pictures changed over time, and in recent years, Quaker removed the mammy kerchief from the character to blunt growing criticism that brand perpetuated a racist stereotype that dated to the days of slavery. But Quaker, which is a subsidiary of PepsiCo, said removing the image and the name is part of a larger effort by the company to make progress toward racial equality. Kristen Kropfel, vice president and chief marketing officer of Quaker Foods North America, said in a press release, as we work to make progress toward racial equality through several initiatives, we must also take a hard look at our portfolio of brands and ensure they reflect our values and meet our consumers' expectations. Kropfel said the company has worked to update the brand to be appropriate and respectful, but it realized the changes were insufficient. Aunt Jemima has faced renewed criticism recently amid protests across the nation sparked by the death of George Floyd in Minneapolis police custody. People on social media also called out the brand for continuing to use the image and discussed what they called its racist history, with the topic trending on Twitter. Riche Richardson, an associate professor at Cornell University on the Today Show Wednesday, said, Aunt Jemima is a retrograde image of black womanhood on store shelves. It's an image that harkens back to the antebellum plantation. Aunt Jemima is that kind of stereotype premised on this idea of black inferiority and otherness. Boy, if that's not woke talk, I don't know what is. The intersectionality is almost overwhelming me. Thankfully, my white male privilege is pushing it back. But Richardson said it's urgent to expunge our public spaces a lot of these symbols that for some people are triggering and represent terror and abuse. Okay, let's pause for just a moment here. What exactly terror and abuse have these easily triggered souls been undergoing? I'm just curious. Have any of them recently been chased by slave catchers or whipped for not, you know, picking their share of cotton? Are any of them actually slaves, for that matter? No? Huh. Kind of makes you wonder, then why are they so easily triggered? And I think the answer is apparent to most people who are capable of thinking that, you know, it really has nothing to do with what has happened to them. All they're doing is looking at a symbol or looking at something that represents something that was an actual, literal part of American history. And that doesn't make it a good thing, but let's at least acknowledge that the truth is some things historically did happen. They did. So rather than pretend we must erase history, we must, you know, throw it all in the dustbin and pretend that it never happened, I don't know that that's a healthy way to approach life. Where do you draw the line on that? Where does it stop? And actually, I have an article I'll share in a few minutes that makes a pretty strong case that it doesn't stop. It just gets worse. In a 2015 piece for the New York Times, Richardson also said that the inspiration for the brand's name came from a minstrel song, Old Aunt Jemima. The logo, Richardson wrote, was grounded in the stereotype of the mammy, a devoted and submissive servant who eagerly nurtured the children of her white master and mistress while neglecting her own. Now, the company's own timeline of the product says Aunt Jemima was first brought to life by Nancy Green, a black woman who was formerly enslaved and became the face of the product in 1890. Okay, that to me sounds more like empowerment. That sounds like she achieved something that's worthy of celebration. In 2015, a judge dismissed a lawsuit against the company by two men claiming to be descendants of Anna Harrington, a black woman who began portraying Jemima in the 1930s, saying the company didn't properly compensate her estate with royalties. So new packaging is expected to appear in the fall of 2020. A new name for the food will be announced at a later date. Whew. I know it's hard not to be snarky. It's hard not to treat it with a little bit of ridiculousness. Because in some ways it seems like this is a ridiculous amount of angst over something that was not intended to be offensive. And I guess what I'm pointing out here is the people who find this offensive largely are choosing to find it offensive. What then? What should we do? You know, do we cater to their every whim? Do we, you know, bend the knee? Yes, yes, what would you have us do? What else? What else? As we self-flagellate? I mean, for crying out loud, Land O'Lakes margarine for the longest time, or Land O'Lakes butter, for the longest time had the image of, you know, an Indian maiden, which, by the way, is consistent with the Land of Lakes. Many, many tribes from the First Nations up there in that particular part of the continent. But again, it wasn't intended as, you know, some kind of a racial slur. It's just this new woke attitude that makes everything offensive. Everything has to be questioned. I'll have to dig up the quote from George Orwell. I run across it pretty regularly now because a lot of people have tapped into it. But this is from 1984, and he points out one of the ways that the party controlled how people thought was basically it altered history. It removed history. If you remember from the story 1984, Winston Smith worked at the Ministry of Truth, an Orwellian name if there ever was one, since his job was to go through and alter history, remove people from photographs, remove names from articles, to make sure that history only reflected what the party said was worthy of being reflected. Every book was altered, every headline altered, every photograph touched up. Nothing could be trusted to be true. And he said the goal was to separate people from their past, to make sure that no one had anything concrete on which they could rest. All they had was simply a present in which everything the party said was right. Does it not seem that we are in a position to actually make some progress on this, but not by removing all the symbols that remind us of what came before. And I'm not saying, you know, therefore we should honor every bad thing that ever happened. Why, look, here's a statue to heroin overdoses. Here is a statue to, you know, whatever the case may be. I think we have to take a little more grown-up attitude and recognize for sure what's going on is that there are people who were human beings who came before us. They were neither completely angels nor were they completely devils. There were some very good things that were contributed, and there were some not so good things. That's part of their humanity. And the part that we have a hard time accepting is we are in the very same boat. There are some very good things about us right now, as well as some not so desirable things. I promise you, 200 years from now, people are going to be looking at us going, what the hell were they thinking? We'll be back in just a moment. And just like that, we are back. Thank you so much for joining us today. This is Brian Hyde. I am so glad to have you on the program. We're talking about the destruction of symbols, historic symbols. And, you know, you've seen a lot of different, images here of late. Statues being pulled down, monuments defaced, and in some cases being removed. It's, you know, I mean, I don't have a dog in the fight in the sense that, well, gosh, that statue of Stonewall Jackson, why, that represents my people, my heritage. But I do have a dog in the fight in the sense that it recognizes that, no, there actually was a war between the states. And I know the winners get to write the history books, but I think the side of history or the distorted version of history that we're being presented with does not do justice to what was actually at stake. It was more than just slavery. We're not going to fight that battle here and now, but you get the picture. And when people start to remove historical symbols, whether it's Aunt Jemima, excuse me, or Uncle Ben, or, you know, or a statue or a monument, what exactly are they trying to accomplish? There's a terrific article on intellectualtakeout.org. Christopher Roach is the author. It's called Unmasking Marble and Bronze. And he gets right to the heart of the matter on this issue. Christopher Roach says, protests and looting were supplanted last week by an orgy of more symbolic destruction. Statues of various figures from our civilization's past, Christopher Columbus, a Texas Ranger, numerous Confederate Civil War memorials, even Philadelphia's Frank Rizzo, have been toppled, defaced, or scheduled for removal by compliant officials. Ooh, there's another story to talk about of all the officials who are quick to take a knee. Please, you know, please give me your approval. They beg of the mob, not understanding that the sympathy of the mob is something you will never receive. All you're going to get is more demands. Anyway, back to the article. In the same spirit, a Senate GOP committee recently voted to rename military bases named after Confederate generals. Those names, Fort Bragg and Fort Hood among them, have acquired their own connotations as centers of excellence, but they must be renamed because their long-forgotten namesakes fought on the losing side of the Civil War. Now, I want to just point out something that Charlie Reese had pointed out many years ago. You cannot understand American history without understanding the American South. And that means understanding the good as well as the bad. And I'm here to tell you, there were both. There were good and there were bad aspects about what the South was doing. The standing up for the preservation of slavery, insofar as they were doing that, that was bad. Standing up for self-determination and states' rights, defending themselves against an invasion from the North, that was actually a good thing. But again, I remind you, we're dealing with human beings. We're not dealing with, you know, one-dimensional heroes, you know, who can never make a mistake, or, for that matter, one-dimensional heroes who were nothing but pure evil through and through. How stupid of us to think that we have all the answers as we sit back at armchair quarterback history. And again, I promise you, people will be second-guessing some of the decisions that we have made in our time. Let's hope that they're not as harsh or as hasty as we see many of the people being today towards those who came before us. Otherwise, I predict our memories are going to be in for a lot of abuse. Back to the article. Christopher Roach says the focus on Southern war memorials is just simply pretextual. No one's calling for a restoration of the Confederacy. Rather, a war on Confederate symbols is part of a broader, large-scale revision of our history, where the nation's past is rewritten as the story of systemic racism. So anything honoring an old, dead white guy is in jeopardy. And by the way, related protests in the UK have targeted Winston Churchill, for example. Ludicrously, he points out, rioters desecrated a statue of abolitionist Matthias Baldwin in Philadelphia. An Alabama professor even floated plans to topple the Washington Monument itself. By the way, if there was one bright spot in all of this, I think it was the response that I saw coming out of San Antonio, Texas, where a great many Texans have come together and said, you so much as think about defacing or damaging the Alamo, and there will be hell to pay. Now, I visited the Alamo a couple of years ago. I was in San Antonio and had a chance to see it for myself. And the thing that immediately struck me, just in setting foot on the grounds, is there is a very profound respect for what went before there and for the people who died defending the Alamo. I mean, the nearby cathedral where their remains are kept in a great big urn, you know, along with the inscription of their names and who they were. There's real reverence there. And it was very clear. I mean, the people of Texas take that site as a sacred site because people shed their sacred blood in defense of independence. And so it's they've sent a very clear message. You come mess with this, it's the last thing you will ever mess with. I'm not saying violence solves everything, but I admire their willingness to put their foot down and say, it's not going to happen. But this leads us to the question, why so much destruction? Why this appetite for destroying all of these symbols? Christopher Roach says, just as statues are symbolic, their destruction is also symbolic. Destruction reimagines the statues as defeated enemies, and in such acts, those whom they symbolize are also deemed worthy of destruction. So I guess old white males, look out. Your time is coming. Dehumanization, after all, he says, is widely considered to be one of the important preconditions of genocide. That is, destroying the art and symbols of a people is a step along the road to destroying the people themselves. You ever watch Schindler's List? Do you remember the crude, callous imagery of Jewish headstones being used as pavers for a road? Okay, we're thinking this is the same mentality that's at play here. Christopher Roach says in an interview on recent events, art historian Aaron Thompson observed, throughout history, destroying an image has been felt as attacking the person represented in that image. Which we know because when people attack statues, they attack the parts that would be vulnerable on a human being. So after a week of violent riots, one must wonder, how far does this go? When does it stop? Our nation spends over $700 billion on defense, but our country and its patrimony are being treated as if we're occupied by a conquering foe. Seattle, we're looking your direction. Our cities are being destroyed. Our wealth is being targeted for reparations. Our ancestors are dishonored and our dead are denied rest. And Christopher Roach says there's something particularly repulsive about the destruction of what is first and foremost a work of art. He says, as a student, I remember being revolted by the photographs of defaced classical statues in history books. I knew this vandalism reportedly was committed by the early Christians in an excess of piety. But whatever the motivation, it was a permanent, irreversible crime against aesthetics. A statue is a work of art with a very unique quality. In their lifelike subtlety rendered in marble or bronze, statues also suggest permanency and an idealized humanity. The depiction of a particular person in a sculpture can portray transcendent ideals that rise above the particular subject in a way neither painting nor photography can capture. And as if we needed this reminder, but it's a good one nonetheless, people are not perfect, not in the past, and certainly not now. But the lofty, enduring qualities rendered in our public art are the qualities that can make us more perfect and make us more human. Our nation, which was built on high ideals, has particularly honored those qualities required to sustain successful self-government. George Washington's public-spiritedness and leadership, Jefferson's reason and idealism, and Lincoln's moral vision of freedom for all men. This pantheon of heroes unified a young nation not bound primarily by common ancestry, but rather through a celebration of those virtues conducive to good citizenship. No one ever pretended that a statue meant the actual subject was flawless. But the statues destroyed this week each depicted qualities we should admire, including the Faustian spirit of Columbus crossing the ocean, the moral courage of Matthias Baldwin, the tragic physical courage of the Confederate soldier. Christopher Roach says destruction and vandalism show contempt for those qualities and disregard the rights for one's fellow citizens to make up their own minds about these symbols and about their nation's past. Well, once again, welcome back. This is Loving Liberty. I'm Brian Hyde. Thank you again for joining us. I've been sharing this article from Christopher Roach, Unmasking Marble and Bronze. And maybe it provides some perspective on why do people want so desperately to destroy the monuments, the statues that remind them of things that actually happened or people that actually lived in the past. Well, if you're trying to divorce a people from their past in order to more or less control their understanding of how did we get here from there, that's a pretty good way to do it. You just erase the past. And again, as Orwell says, nothing exists but an ever present where the party is always right or where the dominant ideology is always right. It's a pretty dangerous place to go. The last little bit of this article talks about unmasking the virtues of Republican self-government. And he says the new revolutionary order born in the 1960s and continuing through to the present finds its most authentic expression in the practice of unmasking. The nation's legacy history withers under this endless critique, which picks at every scab and exposes every flaw. Now, the greatness of George Washington is forgotten. Instead, we remember inane trivialities such as, well, George Washington had wooden teeth, although he didn't. The cultural revolutionaries find not only the nation, but the whole concept of an elevated humanity to be a myth that must be unmasked and discarded. And this had much to do with the explosion of scatological and sexual foul language during the counterculture revolution of the 60s. Such language is now so commonplace as to be unremarkable, but the reason it was criticized initially is because it reduces our humanity to the lowest of bodily functions. Just as unmasking history reduces our national story to nothing but a long list of offenses. Now look, there are many regrets and injustices to be found in every nation and in every individual. But these demerits are no less true of other institutions we take pride in, such as our church or our alma maters or our families. The question you have to ask is, are these flaws the essence of the story? Does this reduction of American history to a ghost story about white villainy inspire patriotism or facilitate racial peace or harmony today? Doesn't it, to the contrary, demoralize the majority while flattering the minority? Encouraging the descendants of erstwhile victims to cultivate a blood vendetta while offering no mechanism for reconciliation? Whew, I'd say that's pretty on target. So the modern-day barbarians may not know the details surrounding the things they've destroyed, but they know full well what they're doing. It's just a huge flex. Language, flags, heroes, symbols, as well as the forcible changing of those things. This is supposed to express who's in charge and what the nation stands for. Now, domestic and foreign policy are all part of politics. But before policy, there is the foundational question of political life. Who are we? What does our society honor? Today, every instrument of elite power honors George Floyd as an idealized victim. He is more elevated than the heroic George Washington, or for that matter, the brilliant George Washington Carver. A cult of victimhood and revenge flows directly from that earlier unmasking of the nation's heroes and idealistic sense of itself. Christopher Roach says destroying symbols of America's past says that the people who built the country, wrote its laws, and fought its wars have no particular claim to ownership or control over the nation's land or its future. The unmaskers label the nation's erstwhile ideals, reason, law, heroism, and chivalry, as fraudulent, a mask for a corrupt core. They aim to replace these ideals with their opposites: emotion, lawbreaking, victimhood, and limitless revenge. And he says this frenzy of destruction is not about marble and bronze. It is rather a symbolic expression, much like the statues themselves. And the message is that the people and ideals depicted in these statues must give way before an uncompromising political program of abolition, not of slavery, long since abolished, but of the American people themselves, along with the nation they built. Wow. That is spot on. I'll share this in the show notes. You can find them at lovingliberty.net. Please share this far and wide. And maybe we have a little bit better understanding now of, why are people doing things the way that they're doing them? All right, let's shift gears now. I don't know if you have heard, but lately I've been hearing this drumbeat, and it's kind of a disturbing one. Do you know COVID-19 cases are on the rise? Oh, yeah, there's talk about a second wave, and my goodness, here it comes. Here it comes. Another lockdown may be on the horizon. Well, we're going to talk about that. And actually, Thomas L. Knapp says, no matter whatever talk you're hearing about, second wave or not, there cannot be another lockdown. If you think that there is unrest, if you think that there is upheaval right now, doubling down on another lockdown would just simply make it where it would be dousing the fire with gasoline in the hopes that somehow we can flood it and put it out. Not going to happen. But first, let's talk about why is it that people have essentially resumed, commercial interactions? Why are so few people not socially distancing? Why do you see people wandering around out in public not wearing masks? This is very alarming to a lot of folks. I see this every day on social media. And leave it to an economist, Tyler Cowen in this case, to come up with what I think is a very reasonable answer for why this is taking place. He says people have solved for the equilibrium. First of all, the socially distanced goods like food delivery are starting to rise in price. The non-distanced goods have been falling in relative price, so now people are moving along their demand curves and engaging in less distancing. Second, he says the longer the pandemic will run, the harder it is to use intemporal substitution as a makeup. I won't go to a bar for 2 months, but I'll go a lot to make up for it, is a plausible story for someone to tell themselves. I won't go to a bar for a year and then I'll go a lot. That's a lot harder to swallow and a lot harder to act upon. So it starts to become a habit. And at some point you can't drink enough to make up for what you've lost. So people are more inclined to go to the bar now. Hey, carpe diem, right? Seize the day. More importantly, he says peer effects are remarkably strong. Most people are not willing to accept a small additional risk of death to, say, eat in a particular restaurant. But they are willing to accept a small additional risk of death to live life as other people are living life. So once enough people are not respecting social distancing, most of the others will follow. This is probably why my friend Eric Peters has been so adamant about don't wear the mask. It just encourages other people to fall in line, to follow like so many sheep. Apparently some wag on Twitter said we can no longer use the expression to avoid like the plague, because apparently people do not take so much care to avoid the plague. Again, this is Tyler Cowen writing for marginalrevolution.com. Why non-distance and social commercial interactions have resumed so quickly. I love it. We've solved for equilibrium. We weighed the odds and we have figured out, you know what? This is what I'm willing to accept. And now I'm going to move forward with my life. And as painful as it may be for those who think, oh, this is terrible, we're all destroying ourselves, this is the way it needs to be. My friend Paul Cousins, Iron County Commissioner, we had him on the program a couple of days ago, has been receiving a lot of criticism from not a majority of people, but from a few individuals who are just, how are you going to face the families of those who will die from COVID-19 because you guys just had to have that Colin Ray concert there in Iron County? And Paul gave them an answer very much like what Tyler Cowen is explaining here. We cannot live in fear. We can't be cowering, waiting for the next bad thing that might happen. It's just not possible. We have to be able to make decisions, assess the risks, weigh those risks, and then decide for ourselves, is it time to move forward? And for those who don't want to do it, look, nobody's holding a gun to your head saying, therefore, you must get out of your house. You must not wear a mask or anything like that. You're still free to take all those social distancing precautions, all of the personal protective equipment precautions, all the stay-at-home precautions that you feel that you need to. And I know, people may make fun of me. Now, you might get a little ribbing, but nobody is going to try to physically prevent you or otherwise shame you as to you should never do that. If you feel that the risks are such that you're not willing to accept them, that is absolutely your right. And I would stand for your ability to make that decision for yourself. What I would not get on board with, and in the next segment we're going to talk about this, a great article from Thomas L. Knapp, I will not allow those who claim authority to lock me down again. We've already seen they have relied on faulty models, they have exaggerated numbers, they have played on our fears, and what was unknown 3 months ago is now far better understood. Yes, COVID-19 is in fact a dangerous virus, but to a much smaller extent than we were led to believe. And the people who have had it, for the most part, have come through it quite well, with the exception of a very small at-risk group, which did not. But we cannot live lives in lockdown. And Thomas L. Knapp has some great reasons why, just the other side of these messages. Hey, welcome back to Loving Liberty. I'm Brian Hyde. I love to I'm borrowing from my friend Eric Peters. We revel in wrongthink just because that's what free people can do. I'm not saying that our ideas are wrong. I'm just saying that those who would say, you can't say that, you can't think that, you can't believe that, well, they can keep trying to prevent us from thinking as we will, you know, clearly and independently. Not going to happen. It's just not going to work. Let's talk a little bit about the second wave. And I want to start with, first of all, Thomas L. Knapp has a terrific essay. This was published on everything-voluntary.com. And second wave or not, he says, no more lockdowns. Maybe this will strike the same chord in you that it did in me. Here we go again, he says. Fear of a second wave of COVID-19 infections is on a world tour. Naturally, the same experts who demanded a global lockdown or shutdown in response to the first wave are saddling up for an encore. Their logic, faulty the first time around, is even more so the second. Now, Thomas Knapp says we shouldn't even for a moment set aside the hideous and lethal immorality of placing hundreds of millions of human beings under de facto house arrest without accusing, let alone convicting them of any crime whatsoever, or forcibly grinding much of the economic activity that keeps 8 billion humans alive to a halt. Those were evil and stupid ideas. But at least there was an excuse, however flimsy, to justify the evil and the stupidity. The excuse was a supposed need to, quote, flatten the curve of infection, to temporarily slow down the rate of new cases so that hospitals could get enough ICU beds and ventilators in place to handle the caseload. Mission presumably accomplished, and then some. In much of the world, the COVID-19 caseload hasn't come close to taxing bed or ventilator availability. And in the places where it did, the virus began to slow down as those availabilities began to catch up. Now, he reminds us COVID-19 isn't gone and never will be, but our sacrifices of liberty theoretically bought us time, which in turn bought us the ability to treat more patients more successfully while we wait for herd immunity, or mutations towards weaker strains, or even a vaccine to turn the disease into a rare and or minor ailment instead of a plague. But unfortunately, Thomas Knapp warns the experts, or at least the newly empowered and increasingly authoritarian politicians they work for, are moving the goalposts, threatening a return to, quote, lockdown anytime they decide they're seeing too many cases of COVID-19. Now, in hindsight, he's got this right. The answer to the first lockdown order should have been a firm, non-negotiable, universal no. We each knew and still know our own isolation and social distancing needs far better than any politician or expert can know everyone's. Instead, we gave the politicians the proverbial inch, they took the inevitable mile, and they only gave back just a bit of it when they realized we were going to take it back whether they liked it or not. Now they're looking for excuses to make us run a marathon with them. And again, the answer we should be giving them is no. Now, I want to transition from this into another article from Stephen Miller. This is from the American Institute for Economic Research. What spike? Hospitalization data show no indication of a second wave. And by the way, I'm not offering this is proof positive that there is no second wave. I'm just pointing out that there is some counter point to the idea that, well, you know, the second wave is coming or it's here and we've got to react accordingly. There's some very principled other viewpoints that should also be considered. And in this case, Stephen Miller starts with the question, are we on the verge of a second wave of coronavirus infections? In fact, is there a spike in infections in states that reopened first? Well, he says the only way to answer that question is to watch as the data rolls in. Arguably, the best data to look at to see if a second wave is beginning are the hospitalization numbers. Now, the media frequently reports the biggest and most dramatic numbers, often devoid of context. The number of cases has been reported regularly since the early days of the pandemic, and yet we know that the number of cases can be misleading. As more people are tested and retested for the virus, more results will come back positive, with the current number of confirmed cases exceeding 2 million in the U.S. But if we know anything, it is that increases in the number of confirmed cases do not accurately convey how quickly and widely the virus is spreading. Antibody tests and even the examination of sewage in some cities suggest that the number of infections is likely much higher than the number of confirmed cases. But on the other side, some of the confirmed cases are double counted in some states, partly because both antibody and active virus tests are being counted separately, but then combined in the total number of cases. Well, isn't that interesting? While the antibody tests have been criticized for their false positive rate, another criticism has been that antibody studies can underreport infection rates because they're not sensitive enough to detect a past mild infection. Overall, he says the bulk of testing is focused on people who are the sickest and who face the greatest exposure. It seems reasonable to conclude that the true number of U.S. infections is substantially higher than the reported figure. But an attempt to estimate the true number of infections still would be little more than a guess. And this presents a problem with the daily updates. To say a particular state or a particular city is seeing a, quote, spike in cases is to say that they recently have had an uptick in positive test results. Now, that could be due to more testing or more ways of testing, or it could be a hint of growth in the infection rate. The bottom line is better data are available. Rather than focus on test results, i.e. cases, it would make more sense to focus on how the virus affects society and our institutions, particularly the strain the virus puts on healthcare facilities and healthcare providers. An obvious measure tracked since the beginning of the pandemic is the number of deaths. And in this case, as Stephen Miller and others at the American Institute for Economic Research have noted, the number of deaths is hard to interpret without important context. So the coronavirus is obviously deadly, but how deadly it is seems to depend greatly on how it enters a population and the characteristics of that population. The virus has been far deadlier in New York than it has been in California, and it has been most deadly in U.S. long-term care facilities. Among children, the coronavirus is considerably less deadly than seasonal influenza. Nonetheless, he says deaths tell us something important about the virus's impact on society. They profoundly affect entire social networks and are rightly emphasized in pandemic reporting. When it comes to seeing how things are going right now, whether the pandemic is growing worse or fading, deaths are a lagging indicator. They don't begin to spike until infections have already begun accelerating rapidly for many days, and they do not decline until well after the virus's spread has slowed. And there's a chart here that shows overall deaths are clearly declining, although there is a weekly cycle where Sundays seem to result in relatively low death counts, and Tuesdays and Wednesdays seem to have the highest reported numbers. Overall, the past 2 weeks have had lower death totals than have been seen in the 2 months prior. But he says if a second wave were coming soon, we would not see the deaths from it yet. And he has a couple of different charts that show this. This kind of comes down to the idea, you know, so there was a public gathering, you know, one of those non-protest public gatherings, one of the ones where COVID could actually infect you. And within a couple of days, oh, yes, officials here in Utah, they are seeing a spike in cases. Why? Because Eric Moutsos and the Utah Business Revival was out there meeting in Tooele. Baloney. Baloney. The virus hasn't even had time to incubate, much less for people to start to show symptoms and go be tested. I'm sorry. That is fear-mongering. I don't know where they pulled that from, but I hope they stood up first. In addition, the article says, in addition to deaths, more attention has shifted to measuring coronavirus-related hospitalizations. Frustratingly, these data tend not to go back as far as numbers on confirmed cases or deaths. But in most states, there are hospitalization figures going back over 2 months. And the hospital data are measured two ways. The first being a cumulative measure, similar to the way confirmed cases and deaths are measured. That number can only go up as more hospitalizations are added to the total. From that number, the daily number of hospitalizations can be plotted. However, that number is very noisy because the numbers are submitted at the state level in a variety of ways, and they don't seem to reflect the true numbers per day. In other words, hospitalization numbers seem to come in clumps. They can be reported as weekly totals or weekly averages, but a weakness of cumulative data is they don't tell us much about the burden on hospitals and healthcare workers. For instance, the total number of coronavirus hospitalizations increased dramatically from zero to nearly 60,000 in a month nationally and then stayed high for weeks afterwards. But he has a chart here that shows the decrease in hospitalization has been fairly steady, and overall there's less strain on the healthcare system than there was in mid-April. The northeastern U.S. was hit the hardest, but most states are seeing either declining or flat trends with hospitalizations, just a few notable exceptions like North Carolina, Texas, or Arizona. Look, bottom line is there are still parts of the country still in the midst of the first wave of coronavirus infections. States that had very low numbers of hospitalizations and deaths in April, but are now beginning to see the virus spread more quickly. But those states are unlikely to see the kind of spread northeastern states did, and there's hope the virus can be far less deadly going forward if policies can be implemented to better protect the elderly and vulnerable, especially those living in long-term care facilities. This is Loving Liberty. Hour 2 is on the way next.